It is an honor for me to appear this evening. I normally spend my time teaching and learning. That is, I try to invite young people, and some not so young people, to enter a world previously unknown to them. I also try to learn, as I have for more than 30 years, learn more for myself about that greatly unknown world, the Middle East, in the past. In short, I'm paid to study dead people, not to predict the future. These are activities which I describe to my students as abnormal. Abnormal in the sense that they make absolutely no difference to what may or may not happen tomorrow, but might have an influence in the lives of others, the students primarily. That's why I was amused yesterday during a radio call-in program when a caller accused me and Dr. Stephen Lebo of the Sage Colleges of, quote, thinking too much and doing too little. Exactly. For more than most people worldwide, this is a painful occasion for us who live here in New York State. We were the principal target and took the most casualties. Probably everyone in this room knows someone who was lost on that terrible day. I first met Father Michael Judge, chaplain to New York's fire department, when I came to Siena College in 1977. He was then assistant to the president of the college. I knew and taught several Siena alumni who died on September 11th. I knew Fred Dirani, a son of immigrants from Lebanon, a 1980 graduate of my own department of Near Eastern Studies at Princeton University. He died at Windows on the World, where he was having a breakfast business meeting. I shuddered as I heard the news story of the unclaimed cars in railway station parking lots up and down the Hudson Valley. The first anniversary of the attacks has brought me back into the public sphere. Last year, it was hard to get people to think at all about why this had happened. They were too stunned and too angry. And I was angry too. Maybe now is the time to ask why and to consider conflicting interpretations of the event. In following this path, I suggest that, as a historian, I consider what I do to be something that never really ends. Most historical matters are in some way unsettled. Too many unanswered questions remain. Too many alternative perspectives remain to be explored. Too many pieces of evidence have yet to be retrieved and studied. History is never final. The bookshelves at Borders, Barnes & Noble, and your local public or college library will convince you of that. My aim tonight is to ask you to consider conflicting interpretations of why the attacks happened. My list is not exhaustive, as I suggested a moment ago, but I am trying to get this audience that is devoted to issues of peace and justice to consider also some rather difficult issues of knowledge and perception. Knowledge is, of course, fragile and changing, but it is all we have. Perceptions are even more fragile, even more subjective, yet real. When I was younger, and you can tell that I am closer to Social Security than to college years, I didn't think much of perceptions. I saw them as totally irrational. Now I think that they deserve more attention, and their sources deserve exploration as well. Social scientists of all stripes like to say that events and behaviors are overdetermined. That rather large word is meant to convey to students that something that happens, or the way people see things or behave, is conditioned by multiple causes. That's why I'm unconvinced by monocausal explanations of September 11. This conflict is about oil. No, it's about religion. It's about the Arab-Israeli conflict. It's about Islam. It's about American arrogance and overreach. You will immediately recognize each of these easy explanations of a complex event. You may well ask whether any sense can be made of them. And I assure you that my own belief is that some sense can be made, that truth can be attained provisionally, meaning that I or anyone else can only offer a temporary answer to the question, why? Equally, you will be exposed to another perspective when Admiral Carroll takes the floor, and you will face the same challenge to consider alternative viewpoints about American security in the 21st century. I am honored to meet him and to share this platform with him this evening. As I describe conflicting interpretations, I will also add questions and queries of my own. These will be critical in all cases, but critical in the best sense of what a college and university is about, examining assumptions and evidence. The first interpretation of the events of 11 September 2001 is the familiar official version given by our government. President Bush said the following during a speech to a joint session of Congress. Americans are asking, why do they hate us? They hate what we see right here in this chamber, the House of Representatives, a democratically elected government. Their leaders are self-appointed. They hate our freedoms, our freedom of religion, our freedom of speech, our freedom to vote and assemble and disagree with each other. They want to overthrow existing governments in many Muslim countries. They want to drive Christians and Jews out of vast regions of Asia and Africa. These terrorists kill not merely to end lives, but to disrupt and end a way of life. With every atrocity, they hope that America grows fearful, retreating from the world and forsaking our friends. They stand against us because we stand in their way. We are not deceived by their pretenses to piety. We have seen their kind before. They are the heirs of all the murderous ideologies of the 20th century. There's much here to think about. First, how can one read the minds of the terrorists? There is absolutely no evidence that the terrorists hated American freedoms, for example, although much of what else the president said is probably on the mark. Second, the president's remarks indicate, in my view, a sharp departure from his earlier attitude toward foreign policy. The earlier attitude, lasting in approximately the first 5 or 6 months of his administration, was an attitude of disengagement and reversals of course, long-standing commitments. This new attitude promises leadership and decisive, even unilateral action. Third, the language the president uses shows more about how Americans see themselves than how others see the United States. Progress, freedom, advanced, these are all positive and even sacred terms in national discourse. Everyone assumes that the U.S. is a good country. Nothing the president said acknowledges the darker side of American history. Perhaps on the somber occasion of this particular speech, in the aftermath of the events, he could not have made that acknowledgement. A second and closely related interpretation comes from one segment of the religious community, namely the so-called evangelicals, as represented by Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, and Billy Graham and his son, Franklin. These people have more influence than you or me. They own a good chunk of the Republican Party, and they turn out the vote. They have enormous financial resources that are expended on television ads and programs. All of that explains why President Bush, when he was campaigning for the Republican nomination, was pressed into going to Bob Jones University, and why Attorney General Ashcroft could proclaim that we have no king but Jesus, when he should have known full well that America is one of the most religiously diverse societies on earth. The basic attitude here is what the religious scholar Diana Eck calls exclusivism. Simple translation of exclusivism, my way or the highway. As a footnote, I will mention two other attitudes or approaches to this issue of religious pluralism described by Eck. Inclusivity, I am right, but I will tolerate you. And pluralism, pluralism being I hold to my faith tradition, but mine is one of many, and we are all God's children. Probably the most dramatic evidence of the exclusivist approach of the evangelicals came on 13 September 2001. Falwell drew an analogy between Hitler and the terrorists. largely because this fits into the eschatological doctrine of dispensationalist theology. That theology posits that the Jewish state will be attacked, and this will be the beginning of the end of the world. What caused a real sensation and an outcry, however, was an exchange between Falwell and Robertson on television. Here's what they said. Falwell: "What we saw on Tuesday, as terrible as it is, could be minuscule if, in fact, God continues to lift the curtain and allow the enemies of America to give us probably what we deserve." Robertson: "Jerry, that's my feeling." Falwell: "The ACLU's got to take a lot of blame for this." Robertson: "Yes." Falwell: "And I know that I'll hear from them for this, but throwing God out successfully with the help of the federal court system, throwing God out of the public square, out of the schools. The abortionists have got to bear some burden for this, because God will not be mocked. And when we destroy 40 million little innocent babies, we make God mad. I really believe that the pagans and the abortionists and the feminists and the gays and the lesbians who are actively trying to make that an alternative lifestyle, the ACLU, People for the American Way, all of them who have tried to secularize America, I point the finger in their face and say, you helped this happen." Some observations. As Ian Markham of Hartford Seminary writes, every religious tradition has a sense of providence, an explanation for why things happen, even when one cannot know in advance that they will happen. Falwell and Robertson articulated this sense of providence from one particular perspective. Others have, I think, also properly asked, why did God allow the terrorism to occur? A second observation. Falwell appears to assume that he knows the mind of God, which is frighteningly similar to Bin Laden's outlook. In both cases, I would say that a good antidote would be J.B. Phillips' marvelous book published more than 50 years ago. His book is entitled, "Your God is Too Small." Nothing in our language even approximates the nature of God. It is colossal arrogance to assume a knowledge that one cannot have. For non-believers, on the other hand, there is a parallel problem. If there is no God who allowed these events to happen, then at least the non-believers need to grapple with the reality and the presence of evil in the world. One of the reasons, and this is strictly my personal opinion, that so many Americans are having difficulty today, and why we have constant repetition of video footage of the towers falling and listings of events taking up page after page in today's newspaper, is that a secular society with a sunny, optimistic value system cannot handle disaster and is not prepared spiritually for disaster. Religious traditions, on the other hand, start with disaster. For example, the enslavement of the Jewish people in Egypt, their later exile in Babylon, the crucifixion of Jesus, the exile of the Prophet Muhammad from Mecca, and go on from there, from disaster to redemption in one form or another. Falwell and Robertson seem to have forgotten this, in their zeal to pin the blame on various sectors of American society. Their lack of charity and their arrogance in pretending to know the mind of God gives a bad name to evangel, which originally meant good news. They are bad news. The third interpretation comes from the terrorists themselves and their sympathizers and supporters. This is difficult to explain because in the current environment, it may come across as a justification for what happened. While nothing from any moral or ethical point of view could justify the attacks, there is some merit in getting at the mindset of the terrorists and those who sent them. The principal evidence here are two declarations by Bin Laden in 1996 and 1998. The last will and testament of Muhammad Atta, the ringleader of the hijackings, that document was found in his luggage, which was left behind at Logan Airport, didn't make the connection flight. And, of course, what you've all seen, the famous videos of Bin Laden between September until December of last year. To understand where these people come from, we have to understand the religious ideology that prevails and has prevailed in Arabia since the 18th century. Even at that time, the religious scholar Abdul Wahhab, Muhammad ibn Abdul Wahhab, who died in 1787, was denounced by many of his contemporaries, even his own brother, who wrote a huge refutation. This is an austere and rightly considered fundamentalist interpretation of Islam. It is literalist, and it is uncompromising. The most disturbing feature of this tendency is that some of its practitioners will consider anyone who disagrees with them, even fellow Muslims, to be non-believers and therefore liable to be killed. A 19th century trend of thought that has continued to percolate to this day is something called Salafism. You may have heard about it. I don't want to get too technical. But this was a movement to revive Islamic societies by going back to the early Islamic community as a model of righteous living and behavior. And there were many positive aspects to this. Among them, an openness to new ideas. It permitted Muslims, therefore, to encounter modern thought on the basis that the Islamic tradition itself had a rich history of diversity of thought and expression. In the published material that we have, there are specific grievances that are then combined with these religious ideologies to justify the violence against the United States. In the earlier publications, the primary grievance is U.S. support of the Saudi regime, a regime which the dissidents in Saudi Arabia regard as un-Islamic because the royal family, they believe, does not follow the true faith. The Iraq situation is often cited as an unjust situation in which the Iraqi people are paying the price for Saddam Hussein's tyranny. The Palestine and Israel situation is mentioned, along with many other things. As you move forward in time into the videos of September and October and down through December, there's a shift in the priorities. The Palestine situation goes to the top of the list. And this is because, of course, the videos are being delivered to television stations and the terrorists are trying to appeal to public opinion. And on this emotional issue, they know that they can connect because the Arab-Israeli issue continues unresolved. Basically, what the terrorists represent is a strand in a rope. Like a rope, every religious tradition has many strands. And some of these are violent and extreme. This reminds us that, in the words of Scott Appleby, that nothing could be further from the truth than the notion that religions are changeless entities, existing above the fray of the temporal, immune to the vicissitudes of history. They tend to present themselves that way, of course, especially when authority is being challenged. But history shows that religious communities, in their self-understanding and in their orientations to the world, change constantly. Indeed, one of the longest-running and liveliest religious arguments concerns the precise relationship between continuity and change within the religious tradition in question, and whether certain changes constitute an authentic development of the tradition or its betrayal. Let me make some comments or observations on the terrorists' view and what we can piece together from their publications and the videos. It's pretty obvious that outside of the aspects of technology necessary for their operations, these people lack an intimate knowledge of the world outside Arabia. We're told, on the basis of interviews with people who knew the hijackers, that the hijackers were stunned when they arrived here and they looked at the skylines of American cities and saw so many houses of worship, because they had been told that America was a country of godless people who spent their time having sex and taking drugs. I find that very amusing, because if you go back to the 8th and the 9th centuries and you read some of the first Christian reactions to the religion of Islam, the thing that's most often mentioned is that all that Muslims do is have sex. So there's something interesting here that needs to be pursued. They also assumed, you know, in addition to the questions of morality and so on, that the United States would not be willing to fight if attacked. And in this, of course, they were mistaken. A fourth interpretation. And this looks at something that is often mentioned in the Arab and Muslim world, that the U.S. must accept some responsibility for the environment from which the terrorists came. To me, this has great merit in that it forces one to consider some of the leading factors shaping the Middle East today. But I would also say this applies as much to the people in the region itself. So I was very pleased today to read in an online newspaper the comments of the Saudi editor of an English-language paper. And this is what he says. Since September 11th, we have busied ourselves trying to counsel the Americans, trying to point out where they went wrong, but to no avail. We have therefore lost valuable time and effort. So why not try to remedy the deficiencies in our own society? Why not try to answer the question that the Americans have been asking us incessantly? Why did 15 of your young men take part in the attacks? We must find an answer to this question, not for the Americans' sake, but for the sake of our own youth. But we must add a few more questions of our own. Why are most of the Guantanamo Bay captives Saudis? Why did hundreds of Saudis travel to Afghanistan after the Soviets left in order to fight their fellow Muslims? Why did they join an organization that was angry at the entire world? I think this may be the beginning of something good. If we look at some of the leading factors that shape the Middle East today, I would mention five or six that, taken together, create the kind of environment that helped to produce the terrorists. The first is rather boring. It's demography. That is to say, like many other parts of the world, the Middle East has a large and growing proportion of its population under the age of 20, and the lack of economic opportunities for them. There's a huge debate in the scholarly community about whether we can explain terrorism in terms of economic opportunities or the lack thereof. I think there's no question that even for those of a fundamentalist persuasion will respond to economic inequality and injustice with a religious orientation. That should be no surprise. But the demography is part of the problem. Some years ago, the Iranians realized the extent of this demographic problem, and they actually began to implement some rather vigorous birth control programs. But this is not universally the case. Demography, unfortunately, is kind of boring because it takes many years for demographic patterns to work themselves out. In the 1930s, for example, someone wrote that the population of the United States would stagnate and there would be only 140 million Americans in 1960. By 1960, there were 180 million. So many of these predictions don't come true. But this is, nonetheless, it sort of sets the limits within which a society will operate. A second factor, female literacy. This is interesting because there have been very dramatic gains in female literacy. The exceptions are Afghanistan and Pakistan. In Saudi Arabia, in 1980, one out of every three women could read. By 1998, it was two out of three. This seemingly boring statistic shows that women, in Saudi Arabia in particular, are going to demand more than what they have had by being made to be secluded from public view. They'll want to work, and many of them do, and they may want to work in situations where they may, in fact, encounter men. And so a rise in female literacy is, for many social scientists, an important indicator of a society's health. And in this respect, things are getting better. Social mobility. And here, I would be referring primarily to one of the results of globalization, namely the movement of peoples all over the world. And the Middle East has exported many of its young people. This is a worrisome problem. Many of them have made good here in the United States and in Europe and elsewhere. And in effect, what they've done is to bring the Middle East here in a way that it never was before. The economy. The basic economic system has still not abandoned the state-run economies of the past. or a heavy dependence upon revenues from the sale of oil. The Saudis have tried to diversify their economic system, but they have left in place the system of crony capitalism that steers government contracts to favored families, like the Bin Ladens until recently. I've just finished Joseph Stiglitz's interesting book, Globalization and Its Discontents. I'd recommend it to everyone in this audience. It considers the failures of the International Monetary Fund to make the transition from communism to capitalism in Russia nothing less than a disaster. And I think that the countries of the Middle East are going to face some of the same questions of the timing and the sequence of creating proper financial markets, legal and regulatory framework, and all of the other institutions that need to be in place for a productive economy to exist. Legitimacy. That's a term from political science that refers to the acceptance by a people of their government as rightful. Most regimes in the Arab world and the Muslim world are considered by their people to be illegitimate, and the terrorists feed off of that. An interesting poll whose results I saw summarized, unfortunately I did not get to the poll itself to look at numbers, noted that in terms of their attitudes towards freedom and self-government, the peoples of the Arab world, in this case, were no different than Americans. That is to say, and they were even more vigorously inclined towards democratic institutions. So there is a will on people's part to have a democratic system of government, but they're being blocked from it. And so that's an interesting point. Another unfortunate factor in this is the perception by the people of the area that the U.S. has a double standard, particularly with regard to the sufferings of Muslims and especially of Iraqis and Palestinians. On the other hand, my comment would be that they forget the U.S. support of Bosnian and Albanian Muslims, not to mention Kuwaitis and Saudis during the Gulf War. So here we have a number of possible interpretations. I came up with four. I'm sure that others could come up with more. Thank you very much.